This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents The Fourth Turning, An American Prophecy, by William Strauss and Neil Howe, featuring an introduction by and a discussion with the authors. And now, William Strauss and Neil Howe.
America feels like it's unraveling. Though we live in an era of relative peace and comfort, we have settled into a mood of pessimism about the long-term future, fearful that our superpower nation is somehow rotting from within. Neither an epic victory over communism nor an extended upswing of the business cycle can buoy our public spirit. The Cold War and New Deal struggles are plainly over, but we are of no mind to bask in their successes. The America of today feels worse in its fundamentals than the one many of us remember from youth, a society presided over by those of supposedly lesser consciousness. Wherever we look, from L.A. to D.C., from Oklahoma City to Sun City, we see paths to a foreboding future. We yearn for civic character, but satisfy ourselves with symbolic gestures and celebrity circuses. We perceive no greatness in our leaders, a new meanness in ourselves. Small wonder that each new election brings a new jolt, its aftermath a new disappointment. Not long ago, America was more than the sum of its parts. Now, it is less. Around World War II, we were proud as a people, but modest as individuals. Fewer than 2 people in 10 said yes when asked, "Are you a very important person?" Today, more than 6 in 10 say yes to that. Where we once thought ourselves collectively strong, we now regard ourselves as individually entitled.
Yet even while we exalt our own personal growth, we realize that millions of self-actualized persons don't add up to an actualized society. Popular trust in virtually every American institution, from businesses and governments to churches and newspapers, keeps falling to new lows. Public debts soar, the middle class shrinks, welfare dependencies deepen, and cultural arguments worsen by the year. We now have the highest incarceration rate and the lowest eligible voter participation rate of any major democracy. Statistics inform us that many adverse trends, crime, divorce, abortion, scholastic aptitudes, may have bottomed out, but we're not reassured. Optimism still attaches to self, but no longer to family or community. Most Americans express more hope for their own prospects than for their children's or the nation's. Parents widely fear that the American dream, which was there solidly for their parents and still there barely for them, will not be there for their kids. Young householders are reaching their mid-30s, never having known a time when America seemed to be on the right track. Middle-aged people look at their thin savings accounts and slim-to-none pensions, scoff at an illusory Social Security trust fund, and avoid reflection on what a burden their old age could become. Seniors separate into their own leisure world, recoiling at the lost virtue of youth while trying not to think about the future.
We perceive our civic challenge as some vast, insoluble Rubik's Cube. Behind each problem lies another problem that must be solved first, and behind that lies yet another, and another, ad infinitum. To fix crime, we have to fix the family, but before we do that, we have to fix welfare, and that means fixing our budget, and that means fixing our civic spirit, but we can't do that without fixing moral standards, and that means fixing schools and churches. And that means fixing the inner cities, and that's impossible unless we fix crime. There's no fulcrum on which to rest a policy lever. People of all ages sense that something huge will have to sweep across America before the gloom can be lifted, but that's an awareness we suppress. As a nation, we're in deep denial.
While we grope for answers, we wonder if analysis may be crowding out our intuition. Like the anxious patient who takes 17 kinds of medicine while poring over his own CAT scan, we find it hard to stop and ask, what is the underlying malady really about? How can we best bring the primal forces of nature to our assistance? Isn't there a choice lying somewhere between total control and total despair? Deep down, beneath the tangle of trend lines, we suspect that our history or biology or very humanity must have something simple and important to say to us. But we don't know what it is, or if we once did know, we have since forgotten.
Wherever we're headed, America is evolving in ways most of us don't like or understand. Individually focused, yet collectively adrift, we wonder if we're heading toward a waterfall.
Are we?
The reward of the historian is to locate patterns that recur over time and to discover the natural rhythms of social experience. In fact, at the core of modern history lies this remarkable pattern. Over the past 5 centuries, Anglo-American society has entered a new era, a new turning, every 2 decades or so. At the start of each turning, people change how they feel about themselves, the culture, the nation, and the future. Turnings come in cycles of 4. Each spans the length of a long human life, roughly 80 to 100 years, a unit of time the ancients called the saeculum. Together, the 4 turnings of the saeculum comprise history's seasonal rhythm of growth, maturation, entropy, and destruction. The first turning is a high, an upbeat era of strengthening institutions and weakening individualism, when a new civic order implants and an old values regime decays. The second turning is an awakening, a passionate era of spiritual upheaval, when the civic order comes under attack from a new values regime. The third turning is an unraveling, a downcast era of strengthening individualism and weakening institutions, when the old civic order decays and the new values regime implants. The fourth turning is a crisis, a decisive era of secular upheaval, when the values regime propels the replacement of the old civic order with a new one. Each turning comes with its own identifiable mood. Always these mood shifts catch people by surprise. In the current saeculum, the first turning was the American high of the Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy presidencies. As World War II wound down, no one predicted that America would soon become so confident and institutionally muscular, yet so conformist and spiritually complacent. But that's what happened. The second turning was the consciousness revolution, stretching from the campus revolts of the mid-1960s to the tax revolts of the early 1980s. Before John Kennedy was assassinated, no one predicted that America was about to enter an era of personal liberation and cross a cultural divide that would separate anything thought or said after from anything thought or said before. But that's what happened. The third turning has been the culture wars, an era that began with Reagan's mid-1980s Morning in America and is due to expire around the middle of the 00 decade, 8 or 10 years from now. Amid the glitz and yuppie mania of the early Reagan years, no one predicted that the nation was entering an era of national drift and institutional decay, but that's where we are. Have Americans ever before experienced anything like the current attitude of unraveling? Yes, many times over the centuries. People in their 80s can remember an earlier mood that was much like today's. They can recall the years between Armistice Day, 1918, and the great stock crash of 1929. Euphoria over a global military triumph was painfully short-lived. Earlier optimism about a progressive future gave way to a jazz-age nihilism and a pervasive cynicism about high ideals. Bosses swaggered in immigrant ghettos, the KKK in the South, the mafia in the industrial heartland, and defenders of Americanism in myriad middle towns. Unions atrophied, government weakened, third parties were the rage, and a dynamic marketplace ushered in new consumer technologies, autos, radios, phones, jukeboxes, vending machines, that made life feel newly complicated and frenetic. The risky pleasures of a lost young generation shocked middle-aged decency brigades, many of them tired radicals, who were then moralizing against the detritus of the mauve decade of their youth, the 1890s. Opinions polarized around no-compromise cultural issues like drugs, family, and decency. Meanwhile, parents strove to protect a scout-like new generation of children, who in time aged into today's senior citizens. Back then, the details were different, but the underlying mood resembled what Americans feel today. Move backward again. In the late 1840s and early 1850s, America drifted into a foul new mood. The hugely popular Mexican War had just ended in a stirring triumph. But the huzzas over territorial gain didn't last long. Cities grew mean and politics hateful. Immigration surged, financial speculation boomed,
and railroads and cotton exports released powerful new market forces that destabilized communities. Having run out of answers, the two major parties, Whigs and Democrats, were slowly disintegrating. A righteous debate over slavery's westward expansion erupted between so-called Southerners and abolitionists, many of them middle-aged spiritualists who, in the more euphoric 1830s and 40s, had dabbled in transcendentalism, utopian communes, and other assorted youth-fired crusades. Colleges went begging for students as a brazen young generation hustled west to pan for gold in towns fabled for their violence. Meanwhile, a child generation grew up with a new regimentation that startled European visitors who, a decade earlier, had bemoaned the wildness of American kids. Sound familiar? Run the clock back the length of yet another long life to the 1760s. The recent favorable conclusion to the French and Indian War had brought 80 years of conflict to a close and secured the colonial frontier. Yet when England tried to recoup the expense of the war through taxation, the colonies seethed with a directionless discontent. Immigration from the Old World, emigration across the Appalachians, and colonial trade arguments all rose sharply. As debtors' prisons bulged, middle-aged people complained of what Benjamin Franklin called the white savagery of youth. Aging orators summoned civic consciousness and organized popular crusades of economic austerity. The children became the first to attend disciplined church schools in the colonies, rather than academies in corrupt Albion. Gradually, colonists began separating into mutually loathing camps, one defending and the other attacking the crown. Sound familiar again? During each of these periods, Americans celebrated an ethos of frenetic and laissez-faire individualism, a word first popularized in the 1840s, yet also fretted over social fragmentation, epidemic violence, and economic and technological change that seemed to be accelerating beyond society's ability to absorb it. During each of these periods, Americans had recently achieved a stunning victory over a long-standing foreign threat: Imperial Germany, Imperial New Spain, alias Mexico, or Imperial New France. Yet that victory came to be associated with a worn-out definition of collective purpose, and perversely unleashed a torrent of pessimism. During each of these periods, an aggressive moralism darkened the debate about the country's future. Culture wars raged, the language of political discourse coarsened, nativist and sectional feelings hardened, immigration and substance abuse came under attack, and attitudes towards children grew more protective. During each of these periods, Americans felt well-rooted in their personal values, but newly hostile toward the corruption of civic life. Institutions which had seemed secure for decades now felt ephemeral. Those who had once trusted the nation with their lives were now growing old and dying. To the new crop of young adults, the nation hardly mattered. The whole res publica seemed on the verge of disintegrating. During each of these previous third turnings, Americans felt as if they were drifting toward a great gate in history, and as it turned out, they were. The 1760s were followed by the American Revolution, the 1850s by Civil War, the 1920s by the Great Depression and World War II. All these unraveling eras were followed by bone-jarring crises so monumental that, by their end, American society emerged in a wholly new form. Each time the change came with scant warning. As late as December 1773, November 1859, and October 1929, the American people had no idea how close it was. Then sudden sparks, the Boston Tea Party, John Brown's raid and execution, Black Tuesday, transformed the public mood, swiftly and permanently. Over the next two decades or so, society convulsed. Emergencies required massive sacrifices from a citizenry that responded by putting community ahead of self. Leaders led, and people trusted them. As a new social contract was created, people overcame challenges once thought insurmountable, and used the crisis to elevate themselves and their nation to a higher plane of civilization. In the 1790s, they triumphantly created the modern world's first democratic republic. In the late 1860s, wounded but reunited, they forged a genuine nation extending new guarantees of liberty and equality. In the late 1940s, they constructed the most Promethean superpower ever seen. The fourth turning is history's great discontinuity. It ends one epoch and begins another. History is seasonal and winter is coming. Like nature's winter, the secular winter can come early or late. A fourth turning can be long and difficult, brief but severe, or perhaps mild. But like winter, it cannot be averted. It must come in its turn. Here, in summary, is what the rhythms of modern history warn about America's future. The next fourth turning is due to begin shortly after the new millennium, midway through the 00 decade. Around the year 2005, a sudden spark will catalyze a crisis mood. Remnants of the old social order will disintegrate. Political and economic trust will implode. Real hardship will beset the land, with severe distress that could involve questions of class, race, nation, and empire. Yet this time of trouble will bring seeds of social rebirth. Americans will share a regret about recent mistakes, and a resolute new consensus about what to do. The very survival of the nation will feel at stake. Sometime before the year 2025, America will pass through a great gate in history, commensurate with the American Revolution, Civil War, and twin emergencies of the Great Depression and World War II. The risk of catastrophe will be very high. The nation could erupt into insurrection or civil violence, crack up geographically, or succumb to authoritarian rule. If there is a war, it is likely to be one of maximum risk and effort. In other words, a total war. Every fourth turning has registered an upward ratchet in the technology of destruction and in mankind's willingness to use it. In the Civil War, the two capital cities would surely have incinerated each other had the means been at hand. In World War II, America invented a new technology of annihilation, which the nation swiftly put to use. This time, America will enter a fourth turning with the means to inflict unimaginable horrors, and perhaps will confront adversaries who possess the same. Yet Americans will also enter the fourth turning with a unique opportunity to achieve a new greatness as a people. As the old civic order gives way, Americans will have to craft a new one. This will require a values consensus, and to administer it, the empowerment of a strong new political regime. If all goes well, there could be a renaissance of civic trust and more. Today's third turning problems, that Rubik's Cube of crime, race, money, family, culture, and ethics, will snap into a fourth turning solution. America's post-crisis answers will be as organically interconnected as today's pre-crisis questions seem hopelessly tangled. By the 2020s, America could become a society that is good by today's standards, and also one that works. Thus might the next fourth turning end in apocalypse, or glory. The rhythms of history do not reveal the outcome of the coming crisis. All they suggest is the timing and dimension. We cannot stop the seasons of history, but we can prepare for them. Right now, in 1997, we have 8, 10, perhaps a dozen more years to get ready. Then events will begin to take choices out of our hands. Though the scenario and outcome are uncertain, the schedule is set. The next fourth turning, America's next rendezvous with destiny, will begin in roughly 10 years and end in roughly 30. How can we offer this prophecy with such confidence? Because it's all happened before, many times. Over the millennia, man has developed three ways of thinking about time: chaotic, cyclical, and linear. The first was the dominant view of primitive man, the second of ancient and traditional civilizations, and the third of the modern West, especially America. In chaotic time, history has no path. Events follow one another randomly, and any effort to impute meaning to their whirligig succession is hopeless. The practical shortcoming of chaotic time is that it dissolves society's connective tissue. If cause and effect have no linkage in time, people cannot be held morally accountable for their choices. Nothing would legitimize the obligations of parents to children or neighbors to community. This is why no society or religion has ever given more than a very limited endorsement to chaotic time. Cyclical time originated when the ancients first linked natural cycles of planetary events with related cycles of human activity. Cyclical time conquered chaos by repetition, by the parent or hunter or farmer performing the right deed at the right moment in the perpetual circle. Unlike chaotic time, cyclical time endowed classical societies with a prescribed moral dimension. a measure by which each generation could compare its behavior with that of its ancestors. Even as belief in cyclical time overcomes the chaotic primitive view, it leaves less room for what modern people think of as originality and creativity. So what's the alternative? Enter the third option, linear time. Time as a unique and usually progressing story with an absolute beginning and an absolute end. Thus did mankind first aspire to progress. Linearism required hundreds of years to catch on, but when it did, it changed the world. By the late 19th century, with the Industrial Revolution roaring at maximum speed, the Western dogma of history as progress reached its apogee. The great achievement of linear time is to endow mankind with a purposeful confidence in its own self-improvement. A linear society defines explicit moral goals, justice, equality, or material goals, comfort, abundance, and then sets out deliberately to attain them. When those goals are reached, people feel triumphant. When they aren't, new tactics are applied. Either way, the journey never repeats. Each act is original, granting a sense of authentic creativity unknown to those who reenact the past. In America, as Mark Twain observed, nothing is older than our habit of calling everything new. Yet the great weakness of linear time is that it obliterates time's recurrence, and thus cuts people off from the eternal, whether in nature, in each other, or in ourselves. When we deem our social destiny entirely self-directed and our personal lives self-made, we lose any sense of participating in a collective myth larger than ourselves. We cannot ritually join with those who come before or after us. When things go well, this weakness is no problem. But when things go badly, the linear view can crack, exposing the horror of time as an unfamiliar void. Progress has acquired many pejorative connotations of robotic technology, bureaucratic statism, and jaundiced culture. It less often describes where we wish history to go. The more we persist in believing time to be linear, the more we fear that the path to the future might now be linear downwards. There is an alternative, but to grasp it, Americans need to return to the insights of the ancient circle. As we do this, we can retain our hopeful intuition of progress and our skeptical awareness of randomness, but we need to realize that without some notion of historical recurrence, no one can meaningfully discuss the past at all. Why even talk about the founding or decline of a city, a victory or defeat in battle, the rise or passing away of a generation, unless we accept that similar things have happened before and could happen again? Only through recurrence can time reveal the enduring myths that define who we are. The society that believes in cycles the least, America, has fallen in the grip of the most portentous cycle in the history of mankind. Many Americans might prefer to think of their country as immune from nature, or to think of their history as riding on such serendipities as a slim electoral margin, a barely won battle, an improbable invention, or an assassin's fateful marksmanship. Yet many such supposedly external factors are linked to cyclical change. And even when truly random events occur, our response to them are governed by circular rhythms that are beyond our power to eradicate. What are these rhythms? In traditional societies, they can assume any number of forms and periodicities. In modern societies, two special and related rhythms come to dominate all the rest. One beats to the length of a long human life. The Etruscans ritualized it, and the Romans first gave it a name, the saeculum. Today, it loosely goes by the name of siecle, or century. The other rhythm beats to the four phases of a human life, each about 20 years or so in length. What the ancient Greeks called genos, or what we call the generation, has been known, named, and respected as a force in history by practically every civilization since the dawn of time. Over the ages, most of those who have pondered the underlying cause and motive force behind cyclical change, from Plato and Polybius to Toynbee and Schlesinger, have pointed to the generation. The saeculum lends history its underlying temporal beat. Generations create and perpetuate history's seasonal quality. Together, they explain how and why cycles occur. During the Middle Ages, travelers reported an unusual custom among illiterate villagers in central France. Whenever an event of local importance occurred, like the marriage of a seigneur or a renegotiation of feudal dues, the elders boxed the ears of a young child to make sure he remembered that day and event all his life. Like medieval French villagers, modern Americans carry deeply felt associations with what has happened at various points in our lives. We memorialize public events, Pearl Harbor, the Kennedy and King assassinations, the Challenger explosion, by remembering exactly what we were doing at the time. As we grow older, we realize that the sum total of such events has, in many ways, shaped who we are. Exactly how these major events shaped us had much to do with how old we were at the time. When you recall your personal markers of life and time, the events you remember most are suffused with the emotional complexion of your phase of life at the time. Your early markers, colored by the dreams and innocence of childhood, reveal how events and older people shaped you. Your later markers, colored by the cares of maturity, tell how you shaped events and younger people. It is through this linkage of biological aging and shared experience, reproduced across turnings and generations, that history acquires personal relevance. The limiting length of an active life cycle is one of civilization's great constants. In the time of Moses, it was 80 to 100 years, and it still is. Biologically and socially, a full human life is divided into four phases: childhood, young adulthood, midlife, and elderhood. Each phase of life is the same length as the others, capable of holding one generation at a time, and each is associated with a specific social role that conditions how its occupants perceive the world and act on those perceptions. A generation, in turn, is the aggregate of all people born over roughly the span of a phase of life who share a collective, common location in history. Like a person, and unlike a race, religion, or sex, a generation is mortal. Its members understand that in time they all must perish. Hence, a generation feels the same historical urgency that individuals feel in their own lives. This dynamic of generational aging and dying enables a society to replenish its memory and evolve over time. Each time younger generations replace older ones in each phase of life, the composite life cycle becomes something altogether new, fundamentally changing the entire society's mood and behavior. History creates generations, and generations create history. This symbiosis between life and time explains why, if one is seasonal, the other must be. Americans' chronic failure to grasp the seasonality of history explains why the consensus forecasts about the national direction usually turn out so wrong. Back in the late 1950s, forecasters widely predicted that America's future would be like Disney's Tomorrowland. The experts foresaw well-mannered youth, a wholesome culture, an end of ideology, an orderly conquest of racism and poverty, steady economic progress, plenty of social discipline, and uncontroversial Korea-like police actions abroad. All these predictions, of course, were wildly mistaken. It's not just that the experts missed the particular events that lay just ahead, the Tet Offensive and Apollo 11, Watts and Kent State, the Summer of Love and Watergate, Earth Day and Chappaquiddick. It's that they missed the entire mood of the coming era. Why were their predictions so wrong? When the forecasters assumed the future would extrapolate the recent past, they expected that the next set of people in each phase of life would behave just like the current occupants. Had they known where and how to look, the experts could have seen history-bending changes about to occur in America's generational lineup. This dynamic has recurred throughout American history. Roughly every two decades, the span of one phase of life, there has arisen a new constellation of generations, a new layering of generational personas up and down the age ladder. As this constellation has shifted, so has the national mood. Consider what happened from the late 1950s to the late 1970s, as one generation replaced another at each phase of life. In elderhood, the cautionary individualists of the Lost Generation, born 1883 to 1900, were replaced by the hubristic GI Generation, born 1901 to 1924, who launched America into an expansive era of material affluence, global power, and civic planning. In midlife, the upbeat GIs were replaced by the helpmate Silent Generation, born 1925 to 1942, who applied their expertise and sensitivity to fine-tune the institutional order while mentoring the passions of youth. In young adulthood, the conformist silent were replaced by the narcissistic boom generation, born 1943 to 1960, who asserted the primacy of self and challenged the alleged moral vacuity of the institutional order. In childhood, the indulged boomers were replaced by the neglected 13er generation, born 1961 to 1981, who were left unprotected at a time of cultural convulsion and adult self-discovery. Known in the pop culture as Generation X, its name here reflects the fact that it is literally the 13th generation to call itself Americans. Viewed through the prism of generational aging, the mood change between the late 1950s and to the late 1970s becomes not just comprehensible, but, in hindsight, predictable. America was moving from a first-turning constellation and into a second. Replace the aging Truman and Ike with LBJ and Nixon. Replace the middle-aged Ed Sullivan and Ann Landers with Norman Lear and Gloria Steinem. Replace young organization men with Woodstock hippies. Replace Jerry Mathers with Tatum O'Neill. This top-to-bottom alteration of the American life cycle tells much about why and how America shifted from a mood of consensus, complacency, and optimism to one of turbulence, argument, and passion. What about the most recent 20 years? The most prevalent late 1970s forecasts of late 1990s America assumed that the trends of the 60s would continue along a straight line. This led to predictions of an acceleration of government planning, ongoing protests against social conformity, more God is dead secularism, delegitimized family life, less emphasis on money and weapons in a post-materialist age, and spectacular economic growth that would either allow unprecedented leisure or plunge the planet into a huge ecological catastrophe. None of that came to pass, of course, but in their triumphal enthusiasm, virtually all the late 70s forecasters made a more fundamental error. Whether their visions were utopian or apocalyptic, veering toward Epcot Center or Soylent Green, they all assumed that America was heading somewhere in a hurry. No one imagined what actually happened, that through the 1980s and 1990s, while different societal pieces have drifted in different directions, America as a whole has gone nowhere in particular. As before, these forecasters missed the target because they failed to look at life cycle trajectories. They failed to realize that all the generations were poised to enter new phases of life, and that, as they did, people up and down the life cycle would think and behave differently. In elderhood, the confident GIs were due to be replaced by the more hesitant silent, who would prefer a more complex, diverse, and individuated social order. In midlife, the conciliatory silent were ready to give way to the more judgmental boomers, who would enforce a confrontational ethic of moral conviction. In young adulthood, the passionate boomers were set to vacate for the more pragmatic 13ers, whose survivalism would be born of necessity. In childhood, the neglected 13ers were about to be replaced by the more treasured millennials amid a resurgent commitment to protect and provide for small children. As a result of all these life cycle shifts, the national mood would change into something new. Back in the 1970s, the experts could have envisioned what this mood would be. How? By looking at an earlier awakening era with a similar generational constellation, and by inquiring into what happened next. And what about today? Forecasters are still making the same mistakes. Best-selling books envision a post-millennial America of unrelenting individualism, social fragmentation, and weakening government, a nation becoming ever more diverse and decentralized, its citizens inhabiting a high-tech world of tightening global ties and loosening personal ones, its websites multiplying, and its culture splintering. We hear much talk about how elder life will improve and child life deteriorate, how the rich will get richer and the poor poorer, and how today's kids will come of age with a huge youth crime wave. Don't bet on it. The rhythms of history suggest that none of those trends will last more than a few years into the new century. What will come after that can be glimpsed by studying earlier unraveling eras with similar generational constellations, and by inquiring into what happened next. To do this correctly, we must link each of today's generations with a recurring sequence of four generational archetypes that have appeared throughout all the secula of Anglo-American history. These four archetypes are best identified by the turning of their births. A prophet generation is born during a high. A nomad generation is born during an awakening. A hero generation is born during an unraveling. An artist generation is born during a crisis. Each archetype is an expression of one of the enduring temperaments and life cycle myths of mankind. When history overlays these archetypes atop the four turnings, the result is four very different generational constellations. This explains why a new turning occurs every 20 years or so, and why histories roll to so many related pendular rhythms. One turning will underprotect children, for example, while another will overprotect them. The same is true with attitudes towards politics, affluence, war, religion, family, gender roles, pluralism, and a host of other trends. Dating back to the first stirrings of the Renaissance, Anglo-American history has traversed six secular cycles, each of which displayed a similar rhythm. Each cycle had four turnings, and except for the anomalous U.S. Civil War, every cycle produced four generational archetypes. We are presently in the third turning of the millennial saeculum, the seventh cycle of the modern era. By looking at history through this secular prism, you can see why the American mood has evolved as it has during your own lifetime. Reflect back as far as you can, and recall how the persona of people in any phase of life has changed completely every two decades or so. Every time, these changes have followed the archetypal pattern. Consider the generational transitions of the past decade, which are once again proving the linear forecasters wrong. As the silent have begun reaching retirement age, national leaders have shown less interest in making public institutions do big things, and more interest in making them flexible, fair, expert, nuanced, and participatory. Why? The elder artist is replacing the elder hero. As boomers have begun turning 50, the public discourse has become less refined and conciliatory, and more impassioned and moralistic. Why? The midlife prophet is replacing the midlife artist. As 13ers have filled the 20-something bracket, the pop culture has become less about soul, free love, and feeling at one with the world, and a lot more about cash, sexual disease, and going it alone in an unforgiving world. Why? The young adult nomad is replacing the young adult prophet. As millennials have surged into America's elementary and junior high schools, family behavior has reverted toward greater protection. Why? We are now raising the child hero, no longer the child nomad. When you compile these four archetypal shifts through the entire life cycle, you see how America's circa 1970s constellation has transformed into something new from top to bottom in the 1990s. That is why the nation has shifted from a mood of awakening to one of unraveling. When you apply this logic forward into the 00 decade and beyond, you can begin to understand why a fourth turning is coming and how America's mood will change when the crisis hits. Let us embark on a journey that turns history into prophecy, a journey through the confluence of social time and human life. You will gain a new insight about why the first three turnings of the current millennial seculum have evolved as they have. You will see why this secular journey must culminate in a fourth turning, and what is likely to happen when it does. Finally, you will explore what you and your nation can do to brace for the coming crisis. It's time to trust our instincts, think seasonally, and prepare. Forewarned is forearmed. The ritual year endures in modern America, especially around the time of the winter break between the old year and the new. The Jesus baby symbolizes hope for the soul, while the New Year's baby symbolizes hope for the world. In the week between the two holidays, many modern Americans feel unfocused, much like the ancients did after the solstice. Now, as then, the break passes. Spurred along by seasonal rites, the year resumes its circular voyage. The original purpose of these solstitial rituals was less to congratulate the seasons than to propel them on, to help nature complete what ancient cultures deemed a wheel of time. There are many different cycles of time, each with a different periodicity. As a society modernizes, however, one circle gradually emerges as paramount over all the others. This is the circle of the natural human lifespan, what the Etruscans defined and the Romans knew as the seculum. Why should the seculum be so special? One reason is that the natural lifespan is probably the only circle that mankind can neither avoid nor alter. The planetary rhythms of light, heat, and precipitation can be mutated or circumvented by modern technology and global markets. The political rhythms of dynastic change can be twisted or frozen by the ideologies and nation-states. The natural human life cycle and its seasons, by contrast, remain relatively invariant. Yet a more important reason is that as modern people exercise their freedom to reshape their natural and social environment, often in efforts to escape circular time, their innovative energy typically reflects their own life cycle experiences. Thus, for example, a modern generation impressed young by the need for peace, or war, or justice, or art, or wealth, or holiness, is empowered to change society's direction accordingly as it assumes leadership. Later on, another generation may choose to reverse this direction, giving rise to a history that beats to the rhythm of a lifespan. To see the pattern best, start with the present and move backwards through the Anglo-American crises. 85 years passed between the attack on Pearl Harbor and the attack on Fort Sumter. That is exactly the same span as between Fort Sumter and the Declaration of Independence. Add 2 years to Gettysburg, and you reach President Lincoln's famous 47 years calculation. Back up again and note that 87 years is also the period between the Declaration of Independence and the climax of the colonial Glorious Revolution. Add another decade or so to the length of these secula, and you'll find this pattern continuing throughout the history of the colonists' English predecessors. 99 years before the Glorious Revolution was the memorable English triumph over the Spanish Armada, and 103 years before that was Henry Tudor's dynasty-securing victory in the War of the Roses. Not just in retrospect, but even when these events occurred, people realized they were participating in historical recurrences of legendary proportions. In 1688, supporters of England's Glorious Revolution rallied crowds by reminding them that the year was, providentially, the centennial of Queen Elizabeth's great 88 Armada victory. In 1776, Thomas Paine fired up the colonists by reminding them of the fate of the last Stuart king. At Gettysburg, Lincoln moved the nation by evoking what our forefathers brought forth upon this continent. FDR's funeral near the end of World War II brought to mind, for millions of Americans, Walt Whitman's valedictory to Lincoln, "O Captain, my Captain, our fearful trip is done." While a crisis rearranges the outer world of power and politics, an awakening rearranges the inner world of spirit and culture. While a crisis elevates the group and reinvents public space, an awakening elevates the individual and reinvents private space. While a crisis restarts our calendar in the realm of politics, an awakening does something similar with the culture. When today's Americans speak of elections or alliances, we tend to begin by saying, since the 1930s or 1940s. When we speak of music or religion, we are more likely to say, since the 1960s or 1970s. In a crisis, older people give orders while the young do great deeds. In an awakening, the old are the deed doers and the young are the order givers. The consciousness revolution sparked new interest in the periodic recurrence of cultural upheaval. The youth fury, communes, and spiritualism of the late 1960s and 70s brought to mind similar episodes in Anglo-American history. The Protestant Reformation of the early 1500s transformed England from a loyal supporter of the Roman Church to a nation possessing its own religion and newly individualized principles of spiritual authenticity. A century later, the Puritan Awakening of the 1620s and 30s produced a new dream of heaven that touched off a great migration to New England. A century after that, the colonial Great Awakening permanently eradicated old-world notions of class distinction and social solidarity from American soil, and historians agree, laid the values foundation for the American Revolution. The Transcendental Awakening of the 1820s produced a tidal swell of romantic idealism and evangelical piety. At the turn of the 20th century, the Third Great Awakening's muckrakers, missionaries, and militant feminists gripped America with a new spirit of utopianism. Lastly, of course, we had the recent consciousness revolution, with all its free speech movements, urban riots, anti-war protests, and fiery new arguments over the morality of America's establishment. Entering that tumultuous era, America's global reputation was as a nation whose institutions could build anything, but whose culture could imagine nothing. It emerged with that reputation reversed. In the combined examples of crises and awakenings, you can recognize the rhythm of the natural saeculum coursing through Anglo-American history. America's ancestors completed 5 saecula. The present-day American nation is beyond the awakening of the 6th saeculum. The Secular Rhythm foretells another American crisis in the first quarter of the 21st century, deep into the old age of those, like Newt Gingrich or Bob Carey, who were toddlers on VJ Day. The next crisis era will most likely extend roughly from the middle 00s to the middle 2020s. Its climax is not likely to occur before 2005 or later than 2025, given that 32 and 52 years are the shortest and longest time spans between any two climax moments in Anglo-American history. The Saeculum's last quadrant does not specifically require total war, but it does require what the Hellenics called an ekpyrosis, the fiery death of an old order and a rebirth of something new. A secular winter is indeed an era of trial and suffering, though not necessarily of tragedy. Though it can produce destruction, it can also produce uncommon vision, heroism, and a sudden elevation of the human condition. Pythagoras was among the first Western thinkers to interpret life as a cycle of four phases, each roughly 20 years long, and each associated with a season: the spring of childhood, the summer of youth, the harvest of midlife, and the winter of old age. The Romans likewise divided the biological saeculum into four phases: puritia, childhood; juventus, young adulthood; virilitas, maturity; and senectus, old age. The seasonality of the life cycle is what makes possible the creation of generations. To see how this works, imagine a traditional society in which these four phases of life are clearly defined and strictly prescribed. Each new phase of life group tries to perform its social role, growth, vitality, power, or leadership, exactly as the last group performed it. There are no generations to speak of. There are no unique life cycle dramas and no creative biographical trajectories. Now imagine that the society is suddenly hit by a great event, some sort of emergency so fraught with social consequence that it transforms all of society's members, yet transforms them differently according to their phase of life responses. For children, this response might be an awestruck respect for elders and the desire to stay out of their way. For young adults, taking up arms and risking death to meet the enemy. For midlifers, organizing the troops, managing the home front, and mobilizing society for maximum effort. For elders, setting strategy and clarifying the larger purpose. The stress of the great event leaves a different emotional imprint according to the social role each is called on to play. Differences reinforced by the social interaction within each group. Children mirror each other's dread. Youths, each other's valor. Midlifers, each other's competence. And seniors, each other's wisdom. If the great event is successfully resolved, its enduring memory imparts to people in each phase of life a unique location in history and a generational persona. In particular, it marks young adults as collective heroes around whom grand myths later arise. When this hero generation reaches midlife, its leaders show greater hubris than their predecessors. As elders, they issue more demands for public reward. Meanwhile, the generation following them, the trembling children of the great event, bring a more deferential persona into later life cycle phases, altering their social roles accordingly. The generation born just after the great event will likely be seen in hopeful colors as the golden age children for whom the triumph was won. And as the great event echoes still further through time, this generation may in turn judge later generations according to whether they measure up to its own standards. To make this illustration more up-to-date and personal, today's Americans need only recall World War II, which deeply affected every generation it touched. World War II left a massive impression on the phase-of-life social roles of everyone alive at the time. It cast missionary generation elders as champions of long-held visions, stamping the peers of Henry Stimson, George Marshall, Douglas MacArthur, and Albert Einstein as the wise old men of their era, and separating them, in America's memory, from the prior progressive generation. The war enabled the middle-aged lost generation to get a big job done, spotlighting the gritty exploits of a George Patton or a Harry Truman, and rooting a peer group that had been slow to settle down. The victory empowered young adult GIs to acquire the hubris of world conquerors, enhancing their reputation for ask-not civic virtue and great society teamwork, and later earning them the longest presidential tenure of any U.S. generation. The war bred caution and sensitivity among Silent Generation children, lending them a persona that produced a lifelong preoccupation with process, fairness, and artistic expression. So powerful was the social impact of World War II that it came to define several generational boundaries. The GIs include nearly everyone who saw combat in this war. The lost, by contrast, include the combat eligibles of the prior World War, and the silent those who remember the war personally and may have even enlisted but never saw combat. The initial boomer birth cohort of 1943 includes the first victory babies, those who were nurtured from the start with enormous optimism and were too young to recall the wartime absence of fathers. Among generations born afterwards, the symbolic memory of that epic war keeps resonating, but with dampened echoes. As the GI generation passed into retirement, the 13er generation came of age without heroes, and amid adult criticism for allegedly having forgotten the war-era sense of community. Today's child of the millennial generation will be the last to have much personal contact with G.I. Joe and Rosie the Riveter, whose old civic values are being freshly emphasized by families, schools, churches, and the media. By the time the next generation arrives, World War II will be pure history, as distant from their lives as the Civil War was for the child silent. From the climax of World War II, shift your attention ahead roughly 40 years to the end of the next great event of the saeculum, the post-war consciousness revolution. From the early 1940s to the early 1980s, each generation had aged by two phases of life. Two generations